I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is, as it happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
the buck stops there. After months of opposition allegations and spy agency leaks, the public inquiry on foreign interference in Canadian elections hears from the Prime Minister.
No joy to behold. Eid al-Fitr is supposed to be a celebration, but for Muslims in Gaza, today it was uniquely somber, a reflection of 6 months of a war with no end in sight.
Ancient history repeating, Arizona's top court upholds a near total ban on abortion that dates back to 1864, but an abortion provider assures patients her doors are still open.
Fighting for their right to party. A group of young women in Iran are in trouble after dancing in a graduation video. A human rights advocate tells us that is proof that the spirit of defiance is alive and well despite the crackdown.
Chocolatiers, a young actor in the now infamous Willy's Chocolate Experience, says she was told to be creepy and improvise. She was phenomenally successful at both, but says she really didn't mean to make so many children cry.
And leaving a hard Scrabble childhood behind, Mattel introduces a new version of the classic word game that's meant to appeal to the youth by emphasizing cooperation over competition. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that assumes they came up with this new version by trial and error. This afternoon, it was Justin Trudeau's turn to testify before the public inquiry into foreign interference in Ottawa. Opposition MPs fought tooth and nail to see the Prime Minister testify under oath after a series of reported leaks from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service prompted allegations of Chinese meddling in the 2019 and 2021 Canadian votes. Prime Minister Trudeau was asked about reports of Chinese officials expressing their preference for a minority government, and specifically a liberal minority. He described his own government's efforts to challenge China, and then he said this.
I can certainly say that while individual officials may well have expressed a preference or another, the impression we got and consistently would get is that the actual People's Republic of China would have no it just would seem very improbable that the Chinese government itself would have a preference in the election.
Catherine Cullen is the host of CBC Radio's The House. We reached her in Ottawa.
Catherine, what we heard from the Prime Minister there, that rejection of the idea that China may have had a preference, you know, a horse in the race, is that assessment going to assuage people who are concerned about foreign interference, specifically from China?
I mean, I think we'll have to wait and see. But the thing that I found so striking about the testimony that we heard from the Prime Minister today, he didn't sound defensive, but it was certainly all of it a defense of the way that he, his officials, the government, even the security apparatus has acted over the course of this growing concern around foreign interference. I mean, even the clip you just played, it is perhaps not even a tacit, but an overt defense of how the Liberal Party has handled not just foreign interference, but really the whole file around China, the suggestion being that Chinese officials would have preferred the Liberals being in power because they were not as tough on China as the Conservative Party was under Erin O'Toole. Justin Trudeau pushing back and saying that that's simply not the case. Everything we were hearing was that they were no fans of ours at all, and really it was all a wash.
Prime Minister Trudeau's appearance, as you well know, follows testimony from some of his top staffers yesterday and today. And there was a line, a through line through all of them, you know, this idea that intelligence isn't necessarily fact. Tell us more about that line of testimony.
it's certainly something that we heard come up from not only his chief of staff, but other elected officials. And the prime minister did repeat it today as well. While at no point did he seem to, you know, throw anyone under the bus in terms of the intelligence apparatus. He talked about them as experts and praised the work that they do, the sacrifices that they make. He did at one point say, when he was looking at a particular set of notes, oh, well, that was a reference to a meeting that a source had said I had in 2019. That meeting didn't happen at all. But he said, listen, that's not a problem, he told the inquiry. That's just how the process works. This is how CSIS figures things out. They get a piece of information, right? This is the intelligence. And then when it is tested and they find out that it might not be accurate, that may lead them to different conclusions. So again, that difference between intelligence and evidence. And while at the heart of this whole conversation around foreign interference, the question has been, you know, are government officials getting the information they need? Are the people in the intelligence apparatus doing the work that they need? Again, the tone from the prime minister was very much sort of nothing to see here. This is the process working as it ought to.
One of the key questions, of course, that led us to this point, to this inquiry, was, you know, MP Han Dong, who, you know, we all remember that emotional speech he gave before leaving the Liberal caucus. There were news reports that he had advised Chinese officials not to free Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig. Tell us more about what the prime minister said today in his testimony about Han Dong.
He gave a rather detailed explanation of how he was briefed by his own officials during the 2021 election about the information they had received about Han Dong. And he said, fundamentally, after he asked many questions of Jeremy Broadhurst, who was running the Liberal campaign at the time and sort of his intermediary when it came to the information that was being provided by security officials, he said, you know, I asked more about what they knew about whether these allegations that were being made about Han Dong were certain. Could they say with certainty that this was happening? Could they say with certainty that it affected the outcome of his nomination to have busloads of people coming in? He pointed out that, in fact, it is a somewhat normal procedure in political party nominations that you would have a busload of people from a senior center or from a community group attend a nomination. So he talked about spending about 20 minutes sort of poking at the information that was provided. And then he said it came down to a binary for himself, for his officials. If they were to remove Han Dong during an election, they would be essentially to some extent interfering in the democratic process versus just choosing to go ahead with things as they stood, not being certain that the interference had gotten to the level that it had actually affected the outcome of the nomination. And he did say after the election was over, certainly they had to and did decide to revisit with security officials once he was prime minister again. Mm-hmm. These allegations and try to find out a bit more about what exactly had gone on. So he presented it as ultimately a fairly simple decision where democracy won the day.
Yeah, he also, one quote that stood out as I was listening, you know, is he talked about a foreign official potentially bragging about what they were or were not able to achieve. And he said bragging is not doing. You know, they may take credit for something they didn't actually do. Did that stand out to you as well? Just what was he trying to underline there?
He was talking about something that his chief of staff had written down in a separate briefing, which was exactly that foreign officials may say to their bosses, I believe he said, in a faraway land, oh, look, I achieved the outcome you wanted. But, you know, that's not necessarily the case. They may just be trying to get credit. It may be something different entirely. Now, part of the challenge around all of this is we don't know specifically what is being discussed in that moment. While this may be a public inquiry, there are still very serious national security concerns. So we're talking about this example as something of a hypothetical without knowing what this official from an unknown country was talking about and whether or not those ends actually were achieved.
How would you assess, you know, it's so rare for a prime minister to appear at something like this and testify at length. What's your assessment of how well they've been able to prove that the system is working as it should?
I would certainly say that his tone today was reassuring. At one point, he was asked about something that Kenny Chu, former Conservative MP, who was defeated, and Kenny Chu believes, as a result of foreign interference. The prime minister was asked about something Kenny Chu said, and he said at the inquiry, it felt like I was drowning, and the most they could do for me was confirm that, yes, indeed, I was drowning when I wanted help, which is, you know, it's so vivid, it's so dramatic, and it gets to the heart of the challenges around foreign interference. In the face of that, the prime minister said, the idea that we need to do more, I agree. You talked about protecting the confidence of Canadians in their institutions. You know, really making this a focus about how people in Canada feel about the democratic process. But I would say there is another layer here. It's not just about the confidence of voters, while that is important. It is about the institutions mm-hmm. themselves working properly. And I think ultimately the results of this inquiry will hopefully give us more insight into the extent to which those institutions are working properly so that people can have the confidence they deserve in our democratic process.
Catherine Cullen, I very much appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Cullen is the host of The House. She's in Ottawa. Just about everywhere, graduation is a time to celebrate. You can see and hear that sense of celebration in a video of a group of young women in Iran. They go to Al Zahra University in Bushehr, and in the video, the architecture students in hijab dance and smile and ride a motorcycle. That celebration has now put them in jeopardy. The president of the university has reportedly said that making the video was an illegal activity. She told the Iranian Students News Agency that the school would take legal action against the young women. Jasmine Ramsey is watching from the U.S. She's the deputy director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran. We reached her in Washington.
Jasmine, what did you think when you first saw that video?
I mean, my first reaction was to smile. The video, it's cute, you know, and it's fun, and it's just showing some young women celebrating a major milestone in life.
Then you and others learned the university was threatening to punish the young women for this. Did you expect that kind of response when you saw it?
I mean, it's so arbitrary in Iran when young people are targeted for doing basic things like celebrating. So, of course, there's always that sneaking thought in your mind. The hope is that it won't happen. I think it's important to point out that the video is cute, but it's not extraordinary. And when I mean it's not extraordinary, I mean that in Iran, young people especially have been pushing the boundaries and the envelope on what is and isn't allowed in Iranian society for decades. Mm-hmm. What makes it interesting for now, this period specifically, is because it really embodies the spirit of the Woman Life Freedom Movement that was sparked by the killing in state custody of Jina Mahsa Amini. The whole world saw that. Mm-hmm. And it's just these young women celebrating this major milestone in life and doing so with a degree of freedom that you don't usually see on display in public in Iran.
Yeah, their heads are covered. They're wearing sunglasses. They're dancing. It's blowing off steam as any graduating class, really mm-hmm. anywhere, as our listeners just heard in the introduction, would do. Blowing off steam, having fun. Did you think, though, as you saw it, in addition to having fun after graduation, that there was also a statement being made that they did this intentionally?
Absolutely. I mean, the statement, it's bold and it's courageous because they're doing it on university property. And so universities have been securitized by the state really since the founding of the Islamic Republic. They're sort of seen as hotbeds of political activity. And the state believes if it can stamp out trends like what you're seeing here, like girls riding a motorcycle, girls dancing in public. These things are not written in law that they're illegal, but they're forbidden by the Islamic Republic. So the fact that they're choosing to do these things in such a loud and joyful manner is truly a statement on who these women are going to be in life. And they're really representative of a major generation. I mean, young people make up the majority of the population, and so many of them live like this. It's just that you don't ever see it. You don't usually see it so on display as we did in this example.
Yeah, and others may make videos, but it's you know, one goes viral or one hits the eye of an authority, and then that's the one they decide to go after, as we've seen in different cases and in different
and
places.
And they have good taste, because it's fun. It's a fun video. The song is catchy, and their smiles are almost infectious. So they seem to go after the funnest videos, as we've seen in the past.
We know the threat of repercussions is out there, but what do you think might happen to these young women next? You know, is there a chance that the university will actually just drop this?
Yeah, I mean, there is a chance. It's arbitrary. Sometimes they will go after people, especially if a video goes viral, to make an example out of them and to impose fear in people's hearts so that they don't do it. Although that doesn't work, it continues to happen. These girls can be prosecuted. They could face fines. They could face prison time. And they could also face impediments to them pursuing higher education. And that's something that the government in Iran has been doing to students, again, for decades, sort of banning them from going further in education to punish them and also to prevent them from going higher in society with these kinds of ideas, which are just, again, a basic expression of fundamental human rights.
We, of course, covered the protests, Women, Life, Freedom, Mahsa Amini, through all of those months. And as you're saying, people are still making a statement whenever they can. But how would you describe the state, the pulse of that movement at this moment in time?
You know, it's alive. And it doesn't matter that the Iranian government used all its force and might to repress the protests. This symbolizes the breadth of this movement, the fact that these young girls, whatever their intent may have been, decided that they were going to publicly and joyfully celebrate that major milestone in life, graduating college, in a way that's truly banned for them. And so it just shows that the movement is alive, and actually they're not ever going to be able to repress it. Iranian society continues to shift. And it shifted majorly with the Woman, Life, Freedom movement. And I just want to say one last thing. Jina Mahsa Amini was among the age group that you see of these girls here. She could have well been standing with them, dancing with them. She was killed in state custody. They are keeping her spirit alive and the movement that she helped birth by these simple actions like dancing in public. So, yeah, it's alive. And I don't think they're ever going to be able to fully repress it.
Jasmine, thank you for your time. I'm glad we could speak.
Thank you very much.
Jasmine Ramsey is the deputy director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran. She's in Washington. It lasted only a few hours, and yet we're still feeling the aftershocks of Willie's chocolate experience. The event took place on February 24th in Glasgow. It was loosely based on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and billed as a celebration of chocolate in all its delightful forms. It promised chocolate fountains, amusing Oompa Loompas, and immersive audio and visual effects, all of which seemed to justify the steep ticket price of £35 each, which is roughly $55. But Willie's chocolate experience was not a chocolate experience at all. Guests found themselves in a largely bare warehouse, sparsely decorated with styrofoam candy canes. There was one small bouncy castle, and to celebrate chocolate in all its delightful forms, actors were reportedly instructed to serve kids half a cup of lemonade and two jelly beans. Outrage ensued, and mockery, including from this program. But performing in the event has opened doors for one teenage actor whose performance as a villain in a mirrored mask called The Unknown went viral. We reached Felicia Dawkins in Glasgow, Scotland.
Felicia, when you signed on to work at Willie's Chocolate Experience, did you ever think that this first paid gig, this very bizarre first paid gig, would end up making you internet famous?
I did not think it would go this big, not in a million years. The biggest I thought it would go was maybe a couple of Facebook posts, but nothing to like it is now.
If we go back in time when you decided to take on this gig, you showed up, you saw the space, that we've now all seen. What did you think?
My first thought was, this is going to end up in a disaster. The space was far too big and props were far too small. It wasn't going to work together.
Yeah, it's interesting that you noticed that and the people who put it on didn't put that together before going so public with this. So the character, the unknown, what were you to do and create?
I was given no direction whatsoever. The only thing I was told was to be creepy. And I was told to improvise because we scrapped the script like 10 minutes before starting. So I was just told to be creepy. And that's what I did.
Yeah. I've seen some of the videos and the children crying in response. Did you intend to make little children cry?
No, not at all. I felt so bad when I seen them start to cry. But some of the kids thought it was funny, yeah. And some were just, like, really confused.
Yeah, they were scared, so you were doing your job well. What was this character supposed to be? The unknown is not part of the Willy Wonka cinematic universe.
The unknown is an AI-generated bad guy. The unknown was supposed to be Willy Wonka's arch-nemesis, and at the end of the whole performance, the unknown was supposed to get sucked up by this big vacuum cleaner and disappear, but none of that happened.
Yeah, well, maybe that's for the best, given how traumatic it already was for the people who visited. But you mentioned the script was thrown out just before the performance. That's scary for any actor in any show. These scripts were AI generated. When you were flipping through this, what did you think?
Well, at first, I was cast as one of the Wonkas, but the script is basically just whole Willy Wonka monologue. So I was really panicking about it. But then the next day, I got cast as the unknown, and the unknown had fewer lines. So I was much more thankful for that. But still, reading it back, I was like, some of this doesn't make sense, because there were some parts in it where you had to anticipate the audience reaction, and you weren't going to know how the audience were going to react. So the organizer just said, oh, just make sure they react that way, which was really scary to hear.
Okay, the unknown was supposed to be unknowable and was unknown. But some people were going online saying, it's me, I'm the unknown. You said, I've got to put a stop to this. What did you do?
And that's the reason I did come out, because so many people were saying, I was the unknown, no, I was the unknown. And I was like, no, I was the unknown. I had to take credit for my acting.
How are you dealing with all of this attention? Of course, any actor wants their performances to be notable. But this is something totally different. I mean, when a magazine like Rolling Stone is calling you a breakout star, how are you processing all of this?
Well, I'm super, super overwhelmed, because it mostly happens overnight. One day I was just Felicia, and then the next day I was everywhere. But it was also super, super exciting, because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm out here, people know me.
Yeah.
And people were laughing along with my performance, which I was so, so happy with, because at the end of the day, that's all I wanted to do, was make people happy and smile and laugh.
Yeah. Well, you have already been getting opportunities as a result. We know you were invited to perform at the London Dungeon over the weekend, and that's it's a tourist attraction near the London Eye that people can come and be scared. It's a little more sophisticated, I would say, than what I've heard about Willy's Chocolate Experience, right?
Yeah, definitely.
How was that experience?
That was the best experience of my life. It was so much fun. I was given three characters, the Jester, the Monk, and the Tower Warden. So it was so much fun having to change how I act each individual part.
A shady experience like the one you had, albeit how funny it was with Willy's Chocolate Experience, it could have easily been a turnoff, but clearly it hasn't.
Nope, not at all.
So what do you see in your future roles? Are you sticking to horror? Are you going to stick to this wheelhouse, or do you want to break out of that mold? I know actors don't like to be typecast.
I love the horror genre, and I loved working at the Dungeons. That would be my dream. But honestly, anywhere on a stage, I would love to be.
Thanks so much, Felicia.
Thanks for having me.
Felicia Dawkins played the unknown at a Willy Wonka-themed event in Glasgow, and that's where we reached her.
I'd rather be playing Scrabble. rather be playing Scrabble.
Scrabble brand crossword games are so challenging.
158 points for one word? I don't believe it.
And so exciting.
5 words in one turn.
That Scrabble players can't think of anything they'd rather do.
I'd rather be playing Scrabble.
From 1984, an ad in which people say they'd rather be playing Scrabble than, in order, winning a beauty pageant, riding in a ticker tape parade, or heading off on her honeymoon. And that might have upset her brand new husband, but I'm sure he understood. It was the 80s, an age of tremendous intellectualism and competition, when nothing was more exhilarating than the fierce back and forth of word-based pastimes. Why, just listen to this other Scrabble commercial.
It's winters by the fire, it's summers by the sea. It's holidays and family. Yeah, it's Scrabble, America's good time game. It's Coco and it's kids, old stories and friends. It's rainy weekends you hope will never end. It's Scrabble, America's good time game.
That didn't illustrate much, but it's been in my head all day, so now it's in yours. Sorry. Anyway, we all know times have changed. Back then, frustrated parents were forever telling their kids to stop playing Scrabble in the basement and go outside and play Scrabble. And now, the kids don't play Scrabble at all because they do not like the cut and thrust of lexical tete-a-tetes, and they're just not into competition. Also, because in 2024, almost everything is more entertaining than Scrabble. But Mattel is ignoring that second thing and introducing a new product called Scrabble Together, in the hopes that once again, people will say,
yeah, it's Scrabble, America's good time game.
I just didn't want you to forget that song. Now, Mattel's global head of games says, quote, for anyone who's ever felt a little intimidated by the classic game, Scrabble Together mode is an ideal option, unquote. Apparently, it's a faster version of the game. It's also less competitive and more collaborative, which suggests to me it should have been called Collabble, but whatever. Unfortunately, right now, Scrabble Together is only available in Europe, but maybe it'll get here one day. And until it does, I'm reminded of something a wise man once said.
Yeah, it's Scrabble, America's good time game.
I'm sorry.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
It's supposed to be a day of celebration, family gatherings, shared meals, giving children gifts, and that's how Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Fitr. But for people in Gaza, this year's Ramadan was different, and the Eid that's following it is anything but celebratory. Hisham Mahana is a communications officer for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. We reached him today in Rafah.
Hisham, what was this first day of this holiday like in Rafah today? I ask because I wonder, you know, do people have the energy, the capacity to mark this holiday?
Today, we saw many families who were mourning their beloved ones who were killed during this war at the graveyard. And many of the families were spending the first day at the rubble of their houses. One of our surgeons told me that an 18-month-old child called Ziyad, who was severely injured due to an airstrike, and he's facing severe burns and injuries in his face, could recently start to speak again after he has lost his ability to speak. Now, Ziyad should have been celebrating with his new clothes and new toys. Instead, he's hospitalized in a very critical condition, just like thousands of many other children who were either injured or who were separated from their parents or who are orphaned and lost their parents during this offense. So in general, it's a sad day instead of being a day of joy and celebration.
We've also, you know, you talked about people gathering at the places where their homes once stood. We've also seen reports of people gathering to pray where their mosques once stood. Have you seen that as well?
Yes, actually, usually the prayer on this day is performed in outdoors, not inside mosques. And we could see many people gathering and praying by the rubble of the mosques in their neighborhoods. Usually you would witness many people moving around in the streets, going to visit their friends and relatives to share the sweets and the cakes and the date biscuits are famous. And now this is all absent from the scene this year. And people actually feel sad that they even the very basic natural celebration of this special day, they are deprived from it.
How would you and your family have been celebrating were it not for this war?
Yeah, normally we would wake up in the morning, have a breakfast together, eat the cakes that, you know, my mother and my partner used to prepare. And then we will go out, take the kids, and just visit our relatives and our friends and spend the day in social gatherings. And then as we would have a dinner at home on the first day of Eid, watching TV and movies. Unfortunately, the family separated. We're not able to gather, and we don't have electricity to watch TV. Instead, it's just another day that passes, but people are reminded about their losses in the very special occasions, social occasions like that.
Yeah. This past weekend, we know there was a partial withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. What has that looked like from where you stand?
We have been witnessing scenes of families trying to return to their homes after the Israeli forces withdrew from these areas, mainly in Khan Yunis Governorate. Many areas in the Gaza City, including from the Shifa Hospital and its surroundings, and the level of devastation that was caused by the military operation there for more than 2 weeks is devastating. And there are still efforts to retrieve the bodies of people who were killed during that operation.
Have you been back personally?
I'm still in Rafah. I'm displaced in the Rafah Governorate with the rest of my family, and over 1.3 million people. The vast majority of them are internally displaced. They live in preliminary tents on the sidewalks of the streets that are filled with sewage water and garbage. This hasn't changed. It just keeps worsening.
So when you hear Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, say that the troop withdrawal we just spoke about was part of preparation, actually, for a ground invasion of Rafah, and when he says that a date has been set for that operation, what do you envision is going to happen?
A military operation in Rafah would lead to nothing but carnage. People have been living under inhumane conditions, disconnected from the infrastructure. They have no access to clean water. So how is it possible? There's no further south in Gaza Strip beyond Rafah. This is it.
The last time you were on our program, the last time we spoke, Hisham, you told us, quote, everyone has lost something or someone that is irreplaceable. How do people manage to carry on when they're living with so much loss?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Everyone has their own level of agility. And I think that this is not something that the international community can't rely on any longer. They cannot rely on the people's ability to be patient and to absorb countless shocks day after day. This is a stark reminder that people must be given dignified access to humanitarian assistance, not via airdrops that are dangerous and inefficient, but the only efficient method is by land transport.
You know, it strikes me as we've been speaking, normally people will be smiling at each other, greeting each other. If they're Arabic speakers, you know, they would say Eid Mubarak. What are people saying now?
I mean, I can tell you what I received when I went to see my sister. She said, I don't know if this is Eid or this is another reminder of the pain. I mean, she received the news of her house being destroyed a week ago, and there's no way that she can be happy because that house used to inhabit a lot of very nice memories, especially during Eid holidays. And it's the same for many thousand families. So when you say Mubarak to someone, you receive a greeting back, and not many people can deliver that response, given what they are going through.
Hisham, thank you for your time. Please take care.
Thank you, Neil. Nice speaking to you.
Hisham Mahana is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. We reached him in Rafah in southern Gaza. Planned Parenthood in Arizona says yesterday's court decision has sent the state back over a century. Arizona currently allows abortions up to 15 weeks, but on Tuesday, the state's top court ruled that a law that dates back to the Civil War era could be enforced. It bans all abortions, except in cases where the mother's life is at risk. Gabrielle Goodrick is the medical director and owner of Camelback Family Planning in Phoenix, Arizona. That's where we reached her earlier today.
Dr. Goodrick, you are living in post-Dobbs America. Access to abortion is being restricted right across your country. Did any of that prepare you for this ruling?
Yes, I think that knowing how extreme our politicians are getting and the total bans and the gestational bans at 6 weeks were so extreme that, you know, honestly, when the decision came down, I wasn't surprised.
The justices, we should mention, wrote there is a 14-day stay on enforcement so that the parties involved can raise any outstanding issues in a lower court. There's another 45-day delay on enforcing this law. What does it mean for you in the short term? How much longer do you feel you'll be able to provide abortion services as you have been?
I think that you're correct in the dates. So we're hoping for the 60 days, and I'm hoping in that 60 days that the legislature will act and hopefully take this 1864 pre-statehood law off the books, which is possible. There are rumors it could happen today. So I'm really hopeful. It's a lot different than in 2022 because now we have a extremely supportive governor and attorney general. So things are different.
Yeah, Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays, we should tell our listeners, has said she will not prosecute doctors for performing abortions. You mentioned the governor, Katie Hobbs, as well. Mm-hmm. So you feel that support there. But this has been hanging over your heads for so long, this possibility, plus everything else that's going on across the country. What, if anything, has it changed in terms of the energy, the mood in your clinic for your staff?
I have the most amazing staff, and they are more determined ever. When we heard the news and we thought it was 14 days only, we were going to be working late. Everyone signed up for weekend shifts. We were going to see as many patients as we could before this ban would kick in. Now we have a little more time, hopefully, and maybe it won't go into effect. But we are fighting. We are going to stay open as long as we can. No one is going anywhere. We are determined to provide this care for our patients because they need it. And a lot of them don't have the resources to go out of state.
What kinds of questions are the people you serve, your patients, what are they asking now?
Can I get an abortion? That's their question. What's going on?
How many times do you have to answer that every day?
Well, I mean, it hasn't really been in the news and people don't really pay attention to, you know, it's been sitting there for a long time with waiting and waiting mm-hmm. for decisions. So people basically, a person finds out they are pregnant. They decide they can't continue it. They look for help. If it's available, great, they're ready. But now with it in the news, it's of course, oh my gosh, can I do this here? How do I get the help I need? Do I need to order medicines online and do a self-managed abortion? Do I need to travel? What do I need to do? And it's, you know, it's a crisis. And they will find out what is the law on this day. And so in the media, you know, it's confusing and they are confused and they just want clarification.
You said that date, 1864, I'll say it again. Mm-hmm. When you say that year, that number, and this, you know, look at this decision, what does it say to you and other women in Arizona, whether they want an abortion or don't, or have even ever considered it?
This law was written pre-statehood when slavery, during the Civil War, women didn't have the vote for 50 years. This is an archaic, obsolete law that does not apply to people in the year 2024. Only 7% of Arizonans support a total ban. And this ban has no exceptions for the health of the woman. It just says the life of the woman. It doesn't have an exception for rape or incest or any other conditions that the fetus could have. It is archaic. It is poorly written. It is not relevant today. You know, we need to get it off the books, and it's overdue that it get off the books. And so I'm, again, hopeful that the legislature, simply because some Republicans are worried about being reelected, because this is all about politics and votes, that they are going to get this off the books.
There are Republicans who have condemned this decision. Stan Barnes, a Republican consultant who used to be a lawmaker in your state, told the Washington Post he couldn't, quote, think of when there was a more stunning political phenomenon injected into an election cycle, unquote. So he's looking at this from a different perspective, obviously, than the women who are the patients that you serve and you as a doctor. But when you look at the political aspect of things, how do you think yesterday's decision might impact people in Arizona when they have to go to the polls later this year?
I think it's going to be profound, because politicians are playing with people's lives, and they're basically making the people of Arizona pawns in their political game. And, you know, threatening a ban into law and then coming back and being more moderate, it's a game. It is really frightening and disgusting. You know, they're not becoming moderate because they're worried about the health of the people of Arizona. They're becoming moderate for votes and to get reelected.
You've been doing this work, you know, for decades, since mm-hmm. the mid-90s. You're also very vocal. You know, you speak to the media as all of these cases and these concerns have come up. How are you doing?
I know that in the long run, abortion will be legal in Arizona. This is a temporary, painful period that we are going through, and people will suffer. But in the long run, this is going to mobilize people to get out to vote if things haven't already done. So I'm optimistic. I mean, it's painful and horrible, but it's kind of necessary. We get this off the books and we move forward and into 2024, 25. And put this in our Constitution so we don't have to play these political games anymore.
Dr. Goodrick, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Gabrielle Goodrick is an abortion provider in Phoenix, Arizona. That's where we reached her earlier today. Efforts to repeal the law in the legislature later in the day were stalled. A woman in Alberta is raising the alarm about her experience at an Edmonton hospital. Perla Estrada told our colleagues at CBC Edmonton that she went to Royal Alexandra Hospital late last month after going into labor and being told that she needed an emergency C-section. Ms. Estrada is undocumented and she doesn't have insurance. And she says that at the Royal Alexandra, she was told repeatedly that she would need to come up with $5,000 before a doctor would perform the procedure. Ms. Estrada eventually left and went across town to another hospital where she got a C-section within hours. Deanna Ramirez was one of the people that Perla Estrada called for help that night. Ms. Ramirez is a community organizer with the Alberta Workers Association for Research and Education. We reached her in Edmonton.
Deanna, how are Perla Estrada and her baby doing now?
Thankfully, they're doing really good. Yesterday, the baby had her two-week checkup, and it seems that the baby is thriving.
That's good to hear. If we go back to March 25th, that's about a week before Perla's due date, her doctor, the one you had put her into contact with and that she'd been seeing throughout her pregnancy here, says you need to get a C-section. You have low amniotic fluid, so they go to a hospital. When did you find out that she wasn't getting that C-section or the care that she was entitled to?
I didn't hear from her until around 10:30 when she called me crying over the phone.
What did she say to you?
The conversation was really quick. She just mentioned, you know, the nurse came to tell me that the doctor is not willing to even give me a checkup unless I pay $200 cash and unless I pay $4,800 cash up front. And I was immediately in shock. I told her, let me hang up the phone. I will call you right back. I immediately just got on the phone, started calling other people to see if I could get some help, because I was not expecting this whatsoever.
You actually reached the hospital eventually, and what did people there tell you?
Yeah, so because it was so late at night, I wasn't able to go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. I think if it would have been earlier, I would have definitely gone. And I asked to speak directly to the labor and delivery unit because I am familiar with this hospital. I even gave birth there myself, so I knew exactly where she was. They passed me to the nurse that was in charge. And she said something within lines that I cannot force the doctor to go see her. The doctor already made up her mind. And regardless of the fact that I was calling on her behalf, advocating for her, they just weren't willing to change their decision.
Yeah. What were you saying to them about what the rules are? Because it's not that Perla didn't think she might have to pay eventually, but she's supposed to be able to get treatment first.
Yeah, so I have dealt with the situation before. Mm-hmm. I know undocumented women that have given birth here. And I told the nurse, you know, usually they're willing to get the care. And then Perla's willing to make a payment plan with a social worker and pay later. But in this situation, the doctor on shift said that too many times had happened where women go and they don't pay. And it just got into a conversation about Perla's status. Mm-hmm. Perla had 9 months to prepare for this, and really just blaming her.
Was there any question? Did you hear anything from medical officials at the time, or the doctors there, or the nurses, that they didn't think she needed that C-section, or that the situation wasn't as serious as her doctor had suggested? Or was this about money from where you stand?
So I asked the nurse that we were quite worried. Perla also was really worried about her baby, of course. And she mentioned there's no emergency because the baby is not in distress. We're monitoring the baby. The baby's heartbeat is fine. And at that point, I contacted Perla back and I said, you know, I just want to give you some reassurance. The baby is okay. There's nothing wrong with the baby. That's when she sends me a video through WhatsApp. And she shows me she's not connected to nothing, to no machine. And she said, like, how can they know my baby is not in distress if they don't have me monitored by any machine?
What is her emotional, you know, her state of mind at that point?
She was in distress. She was very, like, worried about the state of her baby. I think that's the number one thing for her. She had been in pain, labor pain, since Saturday.
She eventually, you know, decides to go to a different hospital that's across town.
Yes.
When was the decision made that, you know, she can't wait here for someone to change their mind?
Yeah, so we do have the recordings as well of a nurse. They ended up finding a nurse that spoke Spanish. And the nurse kind of explained the whole situation to Perla again in Spanish. And she said, the doctors as a department here at the Royal Alex have already decided that this is their policy, that they won't give medical attention unless patients pay cash. And they were very insistent about cash up front. And she says, I also work at another hospital. You can try your luck at another hospital. That's when Perla asked, okay, where should I go? And then the nurse was said, I work at Misericordia Hospital. You should try there. It's about, I would say, like at least a 20-minute drive.
What could have happened if something went wrong while she was in transit?
Yeah, that's also another thing that Perla mentions to the nurse. You know, at this point, she was so tired. It was around like 1:30 when they were having this conversation, and she was tired. She hadn't eaten anything. it was late. She was going to feel cold. And she tells the nurse, I'm just so exhausted. I'm going to go home. And that even the nurse says, no, you cannot go home. You need medical attention. You have to go to another hospital. And also proves that when she gets to the other hospital at Misericordia, they gave her medical attention and she had the C-section within hours of arriving.
There was no request for money.
No. No request for money. The nurses and the doctors were quite shocked to hear that this had happened because she was left without care at the Royal Alex for over 9 hours, I believe.
We did contact the Royal Alexander Hospital for comment. Eventually, our producer got a response, not from that hospital, but from a spokesperson at Alberta Health Services, who said, quote, AHS is very concerned about this case and is currently investigating the details. We are also reaching out to the patient to discuss her concerns, unquote. Do you know if that conversation has happened? Has she been able to speak with AHS?
Yes. Friday evening, they gave her a call. I got on the call just to be able to translate for her. They wanted to know, not necessarily the details, but to hear from her what had happened.
And did they give any assurances or an idea of what might happen now?
The person over the phone mentioned that they were going to do like a thorough investigation and mentioned quite a few times it was going to be like a long investigation. It was going to take them a long time to fully understand. He also apologized to Perla for what had happened, for both the situation and also the nurse's comments.
How does that apology sit with her? What has she told you about that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't think an apology is going to fix this. She didn't even mention anything. She didn't even say thank you. Like, apology is not going to fix this.
Deanna, I thank you for your time.
No, thank you.
Deanna Ramirez is a community organizer with the Alberta Workers Association for Research and Education. We reached her in Edmonton. That statement from Alberta Health Services went on to say, quote, all patients should be able to access emergency care regardless of their ability to pay. Anyone who is in Alberta will receive emergency medical care if they need it. Out-of-country patients will be billed in certain cases almost always after care has been provided, unquote. What's in a name? When you're applying for a job, a lot more than you'd hope, according to a new study. The researchers sent out tens of thousands of CVs with identical qualifications but different made-up names for the applicants. And they found that names associated with black people, like Jamal or Lakeisha, got fewer responses than stereotypically white names like Greg or Emily. Their initial findings made headlines when they were first revealed a couple of years ago, but this week, for the first time, in a report entitled A Discrimination Report Card, the Bureau of Economic Research released the names of the companies they studied. Patrick Klein is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and one of the co-authors of the study. We reached him in Berkeley, California.
Professor Klein, I know the study was completed in 2021. Some of your findings were made public back then, but you're just releasing the names of the companies now. Why is that?
Yeah, well, to give you an analogy, imagine having a conversation over a very poor phone line. There's a lot of noise in the background.
Yeah. In my line of work, yeah.
And when you're looking at almost 100 different companies, the amount of noise in total across all those companies is quite substantial. Even people with PhDs in statistics fight about how to interpret such data. We wanted to have a more comprehensive methodology that gave us a way to reliably communicate what we found to the public in a way that accounts for the noise.
Two of the companies that performed poorly and stood out, according to your research, were the used car retailer AutoNation and an auto parts seller called Genuine Parts Company. From where you stand, as you see it, is there any way to account for their performance other than bias?
So it's true that we found that those two companies got the worst grade, and we suspect that they have very strong preferences for applicants with distinctively white names. And that is our measure of bias. The exact magnitude of the preference, our best estimate was that it's bigger than 20%. There were also a number of companies that had almost negligible biases against black names. And we think that those findings are actually just as interesting as the finding that some companies have mm-hmm. very large biases against black names. And the reason is that a lot of the debate about discrimination in the literature has been about whether markets in general have racial preferences or mm-hmm. sex preferences. And what we're trying to do is zoom in and distinguish between a setting where there's just kind of an innate level of background bias inherent to markets, or whether it's possible for particular organizations to do better than the average.
Well, on that, you know, we did reach out to both of those companies we've mentioned. We have not heard back from either of them yet. The New York Times does quote a statement from Genuine Parts that reads, quote, "We are always evaluating our practices to ensure inclusivity and break down barriers," end quote. What would you recommend companies like Genuine Parts or AutoNation do to address what your report suggests?
I think that there's a couple clues in our findings to what companies can do. So one of the key findings we had in a previous paper analyzing the same experiment is that companies that are federal contractors, which are subject to higher compliance standards with equal opportunity laws, they tend to have smaller biases on average when it comes to race. And we think that that suggests that their recruiting practices are likely different.
And on the flip side, companies that perform poorly in your study, what did they have in common?
So the companies that performed poorly tended to have more decentralized callbacks. They tended to not be federal contractors. And interestingly, companies that perform poorly tended to have lower profit margins, which is something, it's a prediction that goes way back to foundational work by Nobel laureate Gary Becker on the economics of discrimination, because he argued that discrimination at its root involves hiring inefficiently, that it's costly to discriminate. So consistent with that, we find that the least profitable companies discriminate the most.
Have you seen any companies do sort of a blind application process or block out names?
There are some intermediaries that have explored blinding employers to certain parts of the application. One debate in the literature is whether doing so just pushes the problem back a stage in the hiring pipeline. You know, all this information is going to be revealed eventually mm-hmm. when there's an in-person interview.
Right.
And there are a number of studies that show that these correspondence experiments are strong predictors of what happens when the person actually shows up face-to-face mm-hmm. and is predictive of whether they'll actually get hired.
Mm. You know, it shouldn't be on the shoulders of the people looking for jobs, the applicants, to try to game out what might happen. But what should people who are looking for a job do with this information?
We've actually recently done a survey of job seekers and their perceptions of gender and race preferences different companies, including the companies in our experiment, have. And what we found is job seekers, their beliefs already align quite closely with what we found for sex discrimination. So we found that their perceptions of which companies prefer men versus mm-hmm. women are very strongly correlated with our experimental contact gaps. When it came to race, the survey respondents were much more in the dark, that there was very little correlation, which suggests that these report cards actually are providing a lot of value to the public.
Professor Klein, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Patrick Klein is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and one of the co-authors of the Bureau of Economic Research's Discrimination Report Card. We reached him in Berkeley, California. parting is apparently such sweet sorrow, according to Shakespeare anyway. And I guess he knows what he's talking about because Romeo and Juliet is pretty good, but things didn't turn out so great for either of them. So I would like to offer a healthier love story for your consideration, one in which parting is still sweet sorrow, but a reunion is just sweet, period. Also loud, though. Mango and Charlotte are two trumpeter swans who've been mates for years at a park in Toronto. Last week, Mango suffered a cut, likely from a fishhook. Fortunately, he was spotted and taken away for treatment. Unfortunately, Charlotte was left alone and bereft. But a few days ago, the pair were finally reunited in a moment one witness described to the Toronto Star as magical. From a distance, the two swans scoped each other out, wings spread wide. And when they recognized each other, it was a giddy, flap-filled love and honk fest. Here are Mango and Charlotte with our sound of the day. You get the idea. That's our sound of the day. Mango and Charlotte, two trumpeter swans from Toronto who reunited happily and loudly last week after a brief separation. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.